Hello, you're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society exists to equip and encourage Christian scholars to serve the church as a center of cultural and civic renewal. Through our events, publications, and podcasts, we provide the space and opportunities needed by academic leaders among Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox communities for professional growth and intellectual discipleship. Since 2012, we have been building a network of friends with a love for our core themes, tradition, place, and things divine, and with a genuine commitment to the church and the life of the mind. To learn more about us, our events, this podcast, our journal, Pietas, to sign up for our newsletter and make your tax-deductible gift, please go to ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society. Please join me in prayer. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, we pray, O Lord, that you would bless our conversation and that all we say and do would bring glory and honor to you. Amen. I'm grateful to be joined today by two great friends, Luke Sheehan and Paul Mueller. Luke is Associate Professor of Political Science at Duquesne University and Senior Affiliate in the Program for Research on Religion and Urban Civil Society is very different. At the University of Pennsylvania, he is the author of Why Associations Matter, a book that I highly recommend, and has done some excellent work on the First Amendment and especially freedom of assembly. And Luke is also the editor of the University Bookman, published by our friends at the Russell Kirk Center. Dr. Paul Mueller is a senior research fellow at the American Institute for Economic Research and previously taught at the King's College in New York City. His academic work has appeared in many journals, and he is the author of 10 Years Later, Why the Conventional Wisdom About the 2008 Financial Crisis is Still Wrong, with Cambridge Scholars Publishing. I need to read that, Paul. And Dr. Mueller is also a research fellow and associate director of the Religious Liberty in the States Project at the Center for Religion, Culture, and Democracy, and he owns and operates a bed and breakfast called The Abbey in Leadville, Colorado, where he lives with his wife and soon to be six children. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Well, that was unison. You didn't even plan that. Well done. All right. Well, Luke, let's start with you. So the book we're talking about today is called The Social Philosophers by Robert Nisbet. The subtitle is The Social Philosophers, Community and Conflict in Western Thought. And this is a republication of a book that I believe was published in 1973. And it is being brought back out. Luke is the author of the foreword to that book. And it is a fantastic volume. So much has been developed here. A lot of familiar territory. For those who love Robert Nisbet and have read his Quest for Community, you'll also like this book. It's published by the American Philosophical Society, by the way. But anyways, Luke, if you could just start by just briefly introducing who was Robert Nisbet and what led to the republication of this volume specifically.
Well, Robert Nisbet was one of the greatest sociologists of the 20th century. He finished his doctorate at the University of California at Berkeley in 1939. He taught there at Berkeley for a number of years. Then he was dean of the University of California at Riverside campus. And then he finished up his academic career. He was at a few other places as the Albert Schweitzer Chair at Columbia University from 1974 to 1978. So he was president of some sociological associations. So he was somewhat alone among conservatives and spending his entire career in academia. And he was awarded the Jefferson Lecture by President Reagan in 1987, I believe, which is the highest award given by the federal government in the humanities. So he was kind of, in terms of academics, he was at the very pinnacle of academia. He wrote somewhere around 20 books and hundreds of essays and reviews and that sort of thing. So he was really prolific. Published everywhere, was kind of knew everyone. He was friends with Russell Kirk. I read through some of his correspondence. He was corresponding with Buckley back in the 50s, with Kirk in the 50s, with Folkes Leander. So he was kind of an international figure in many ways. His most famous book is The Quest for Community, which was his first book published in 1953. It ended up being kind of a groundbreaking book in our understanding of how the modern state damages intermediary associations, and it is up as often listed as one of the top conservative books in the post-war conservative renaissance. Although he didn't intend it to be that way, he published it with Oxford University Press. He was an academic. It was just he was just being an academic, but it ended up being a really interesting book because of his focus upon associations that are not the political state and the damage that the political state does to those associations as it aggregates power, especially over the last 500 years. So Nisbet's a very important figure, and his main thesis that he really, the thread that holds many of his books together, is the study of community, what it is, how it can integrate human beings into meaningful lives, and also how it can cause alienation if those communities decline. Now, the book that that we're talking about today, The Social Philosophers, he published this in 1973, so 20 years after publishing his first book, Quest for Community. And it was kind of a... He published Quest for Community, and then he spent some time in administration and that sort of thing. It wasn't really until he was in his 50s that he goes back into academia and starts publishing a lot. And so he has this whole raft of books that come out during this time, and frankly, like, I'm a little biased on being a Nisbet scholar, but brilliant stuff he's publishing. And I think this book here is actually his most brilliant in his entire oeuvre. And the reason is that the premise of the book is that all of social thought, starting at the very beginning, starting with Socrates and the pre-Socratics and all of that, it's an attempt to articulate a vision of community. That's what all of them are doing for the last 2,500 years. And the way he frames it is, human beings have lived in kinship communities of some sort for, as far as we know, forever. That's just how human beings are, is that's what our species does. So we live in clans, tribes, these sorts of things. And then along comes the political community. And the political community its function was specifically to break up those kinship bonds, to become the sole source of community, to break up the tribes and clans, and to re-aggregate individuals upon a different basis. And then you get social thought. And the political philosophers start to try to articulate the reasons that this happens and the crisis it creates in the human psyche. And that's where we get Socrates talking about justice and that sort of thing. And we get the rest of social thought flowing out of that.
So, I mean, in many ways, this seems like an expanded version of the quest for community when I read it. I mean, Quest for Community has a very specific argument it's going for, right, as you mentioned. And that's the book that most people have read by Nisbet, is The Quest for Community. Is it, well, I guess I have two questions. Do you think that's accurate? Is this essentially, for lack of a better word, a blown up version of The Quest for Community that's just more in depth? And then also, why specifically, why bring it back now? Like, why is this being republished now? Why do you think it matters today? And I'd like, you know, after Luke, you answer that, we'll get Paul's take on that as well.
Yeah. So while I was working on my Why Associations Matter book, I was reading through Nisbet's oeuvre. And when I came across this book, I actually had trouble tracking down a copy. And I just had to track down a copy, read it so that I could say that I read it when I was including, you know, my chapters on Nisbet as part of scholarly due diligence, and realized it's utterly brilliant. And when I looked into it, the reason it goes it you can't find copies had to do with the publisher goes under like right after the like 1973, like just later that month the publisher went under, and so it just did not get the boost that it needed. It got a couple of reviews and sociological publications, but you frankly can't track down a copy. There ended up being an abbreviated version published 10 years later that also frankly left out the most important chapter, which is the last chapter, and it just of course didn't go anywhere. And so I thought, well, first of all, it's just from a scholarly perspective, absolutely brilliant. And so it needs to be out there. The second thing is, right now, we're doing a lot of rethinking. I mean, we talk about polarization and kind of constitutional crises and those sorts of things. But what that means is it's kind of an exciting time, though, because you get to rearticulate all sorts of things and ideas. We're kind of rethinking the nature of our constitutional order. And what Nisbet's book helps us do is it really helps us think, what is the American constitutional order? What type of community is it? And we'll get into the type of communities here shortly. Is it a political community or is it a plural community? This really matters. What type of community is even our understanding of religion? How does that fit in? Where do families fit in? We're rethinking that as we have a the birth dearth crisis. Paul's not having that crisis, but lots of other people are having that crisis. So we're going to think through that. So this book, I think, is really important to helping us think through these major issues and kind of. And I'll say it's just kind of a from a sort of a selfish perspective, it being one of the best things in my career was focusing on Nisbet because his voice is, despite the fact that people say they've read Quest for Community and people know his name, his perspective is almost never represented when we were actually talking about concrete issues. And I'll be kind of surprised when I'll hear in debates and I realize that these are like internal debates. We'll talk about these communities within the political community. There, we won't see the actual perspective of what the religious community might be, what it might look like to have a plural community understanding. And you, I mean, I'm an expert on, the First Amendment, and the scholars are kind of circling the drain in terms of their scholarly arguments. They have no big picture that they can rethink how we might frame our discussion of those five clauses and what they might mean in a broader context. They really just focus on this, primary interrelationship between the individual expressing things and the state censoring sometimes, and that's the only framing that they have. Nisbet would say, "Well, you're entirely trapped within the idea of the political community, and you can't think outside of that." So I think it really helps us think about these broader issues.
I want to get to Paul here. Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
To answer your other question, Josh, I think I wouldn't say it's just an expansion of Quest for Community. He's doing a lot of different things in this book. So Quest for Community is really talking about the modern world and the political community in particular, and especially the state, as Luke was referring to, and how the state obliterates various kinds of civil associations, private associations, voluntary associations, and also how not only does it destroy them in various ways, more importantly, it prevents new ones from forming. So Nisbet points out from a historical standpoint, associations are created and they're always going away because societies are changing, families are changing. So there's not as if there's some stable period in history where we have all the civil associations and voluntary associations that are just static. So there's always a kind of change, a birth and a death of these things. What's interesting in the 20th century with the modern, very strong political state is that you see a decline in how voluntary associations form, that you're having fewer and fewer voluntary associations form as the old ones die out. Social philosophers, the book we're looking at here, is a much more sweeping, and I agree with Luke, a brilliant take, very, very interesting take on the history of philosophy. And as I was reading this, it gave me a very different view on what Machiavelli or Hobbes or even Plato are actually doing and kind of the context they're in and what their project really is. It might be worth kind of outlining the book just very briefly here. And this is my take, and Luke can modify it and correct if I miss anything. But I think it'd be helpful for listeners to understand that the way I see it, he talks about six organizing principles of community or six kinds of community. And the way I read it is you have kind of like three major keys and three minor keys. So the major keys, the most fundamental and powerful forms of community and the most prevalent are the military community, the political community, and the religious community. And he gives examples. We can probably go in and talk about some of those examples here in a bit. And then the minor keys, and these are also more recent, still important, but more recent, is the revolutionary community, the ecological community, and the plural community. And these are, I would say, kind of like minor keys, but important minor keys in terms of modifying or offering a different vision of social life in the modern world. This is an aside, but Luke, hearing your intro of Nisbet being in California, it makes more sense now why he has a soft spot for the ecological community. Because I'm reading this, I'm like, this is just weird. He has this like Proudhon and like these, anarchist socialist people coming from California. That makes a little more sense.
Yeah, it's a the organization was, one of the more original parts of this. And just hearing you guys talk made me think about how he it's almost like an alternative. I mean, it's a social philosophy, but it's also in some ways an alternative political philosophy, right? I mean, this is you could set this aside other works of the history of political thought in particular. I'm thinking of Eric Voigtland especially, where you can think of, how did these things develop? And for Nisbet, it's that quest for community, that desire for community, is at the core of it, is the core organizing principle in many ways of what the social is, or what the political is. And he also has this notion of, I wanted to bring this up at some point, you can feel free to respond to this, the notion of an anti-community. This is actually on page one of the book. Let me see if I can find it here, but he closely related to the idea of community, he says, forming its negative backdrop, as it were, is the idea of anti-community. And there are many ways in which this idea can be expressed, given vivid manifestation, and all of them are current in our own time. There is the fear of social void, of alienation, of estrangement from others, even from one's own self, of a loss of identity, of great open spaces, of impersonality and rejection. Throughout the history of social thought, indeed throughout human history, the power of the idea of community has lain in large degree in fear of apprehension of the opposite of community. And what's very striking to me here is, of course, this book's written in the 1970s, which I think shows up. I think that personality is there a lot, if that makes sense. But the forces of anti-community seem to be winning in many instances. And he's giving us, I don't know if he's giving us a prescription, but he's giving us a vision of how do we resist anti-community. If that makes sense. So with that in mind, I'm wondering, Luke, and I want to go back to kind of outlining the different communities and defining them briefly. We can't dive into them. I was thinking we might dive in specifically to the religious one in particular, and then the ecological and the last one, the plural community. But I mean, Luke, what do you think there's a prescriptive element of this book? The quest for community is saying, look, state is undermining the civil associations, but now we need to, so we need to get the state out of the way so civil associations can happen. What's the prescription here? Is there one? And I'm wondering if Paul has a thought on that too. We'll start with Luke.
Yeah, so it is somewhat prescriptive. It's not forthrightly, in a scholarly way, is just describing things, of course. But he concludes with the plural community, the sixth type of community. So that is somewhat his prescription. He refers to it as perhaps man's last best hope, is that type of community. And so we can kind of go through each of these and delve into the religious community a little bit more. So he has the military community, the political community, and the religious community, the three major keys, as Paul put it. And I think that's well put. The military community, he describes, is the type of community that forms when war is necessary. Kinship community is great for all sorts of things. It's not good at winning wars. The authority structure it has is not good for the command of men on the battlefield. So you get the rise of a chieftain, and you get the breaking of kinship bonds. When the chieftain arises and he goes to war, all of his soldiers have to be utterly obedient to him. That means they cannot be obedient to their paterfamilias or materfamilias. And so when that happens, it breaks the kinship bond. And he says you used to kind of see that arise in history. You see the rise of the Caesars. They're generals. You see the rise of Cleisthenes in Athens. He's a general. So usually there's a crisis of war, and you get the founding of the political state out of that military community. And so the second type of community is the political community. So it's when you have some sort of crisis, usually war, and then you get an institutionalization of the military apparatus. So the chieftain becomes the king, or something like that, or becomes the Caesar. The Caesar becomes the Caesar, effectively. And what that means is you get the Lex Julii in Rome, for example. So the laws of the Julii family and Augustus, and it's what it is a breaking of the power of the kinship bond. So that means individual soldiers in Rome, they go off to war, be under their general, and then when they came back to Rome, they had to turn over all their booty to their family. They were back under the authority of their family. They were not under the authority of the general. That changes under the Caesars, and it changes under the law, the Lex Julii. They change that. So now the loyalty of the individual soldier is to the general. He's the one who gives out everything, and not to their family. So we get the basically the formation of the modern state. Us citizens, we get all our rights and duties to the state and from the state. And so that's the political community in essence. And the way he and why it's the political community and not something else is it's articulated by these great political thinkers. Hobbes, Plato, Rousseau are the main ones, but there are others in there who are thinking in terms of this being where the action is at, is our political citizenship and the political state. And if we're going to achieve justice, it'll be because the political state is rightly ordered. If we're going to have order, it'll be because the political state is rightly ordered. If we're going to have morality and personal fulfillment, you see this in Rousseau, it'll be because the political order is rightly ordered. So everything comes down to that fundamental community. And then they articulate why every other social bond has to be subservient to that. So for Hobbes, it's for order. I mean, you don't want to risk civil war. Those are destructive. Those are bad. So you want the king to be over everything, including the church and including the family. And Rousseau, it's even more so. You do not want those partial communities. Religion and family must be utterly subservient to the state in all ways. And education's a great way of working that out.
Paul, you want to jump in there real quick?
I do, yeah. I'd like to add you just, some layers to what Luke is saying here that might be helpful. So agree with everything he said. So one of the ways I described it is that the political state sort of arises out of the ashes of the kinship bonds that have been burned down through war. And it is kind of an institutionalization of the war structure. But something that I think is important, and this was really helpful for me that I didn't really have as good of a sense of till I read Nisbet, is most people don't have much sense of what the kinship society really is. We haven't lived in it for thousands of years. And if you look at sort of early Greek or early Roman, before the military and political communities form, and it's more of this kinship structure, it's really a very strange, from our modern perspective, kind of arrangement. Property is not a private thing. You don't own your property. Like, property is owned communally by families and it's very hierarchical. You don't form contracts with other people as individuals. There might be some relationships between tribes or families, but you don't have rights as individuals. You're sort of part of this group. Even justice, it tends to be a familial kind of thing. And so you don't have the magistrate or the judge or some kind of political ruler in this kinship world. It's all sort of within the family. And the paterfamilias in the Roman world is a great example of this, where the father is like priest and king in a lot of ways of the family. And you have your individual family. And so marriage is as much an adoption into a new family as it is like a relationship between a husband and a wife. And so there's these really, really deep bonds. And with the military, not only there's a loyalty change, as Luke was talking about, but the way we relate to one another. And so merit becomes more important, where it's not about being senior in terms of age or being the eldest male in a family. There's about achievement, there's merit, there's contract, the idea of property begins to arise, individual property. All of these relations change in the sort of military context and then get institutionalized in the political context. And so that's why it's so radical that justice now is being enforced not by within a family, but by some state. And so when you read Plato or Socrates and they're talking about what is justice, is it beyond what's good for one's family or one's friends? That's a really like live question for them, because historically it was all about family and kinship, and now it's political, it's something different. And so Plato in the Republic, part of why it's such a masterpiece is he is wrestling with this idea. And you have a world now where individuals, I think Nisbet says something to the effect of individuals begin to emerge when the kinship structures are broken down as sort of thinkers, as independent people or entities with ideas, property, rights, contract. So anyway, so that's kind of some of the details of the institutional change that happens that kicks off Western civilization, so to speak, and modern philosophy or philosophy in general.
So going back then, let's keep building on these different categorizations. There's so much I could say about that. One of the things that comes up with what Paul just said, it made me think that is Nisbet doing a different version of Rousseau's Second Discourse? That's a longer question, right? Maybe for the first or second discourse, because we know Nisbet hates Rousseau. But is there something where he's actually kind of building a little bit on that? Now, let's move to the religious one. And I have a question after you explain, what is Nisbet trying to put forward in describing the religious community in contrast to the political and military?
Yeah, so the religious community really comes about with Christianity, because as Paul said, kind of the previous iterations of religion, it was, there's actually like some debate of whether or not it existed, but I think you'd say it existed, but it was very much melded with the family. It was often ancestor worship or some version of that, something close to it. Or if it was still like the gods of your city or whatever, then we get the universal religion of Christianity. It says there's one God. There are no gods of your city, or if there are, there are demons, is what it says. And so we all are under this God and all part of of his family, in effect. So religion very much adopts kinship language. We hear all the time about brothers and sisters. And so what he says is this, and it gets articulated in St. Paul, of course, and then really, really fleshed out with St. Augustine in a City of God. So he's saying, look, where the action is at is in the church. So yeah, there's this political communities out there, and we got to live in them. But the action is that is being part of this fundamental religious community, and that's what we're going to focus on, and that's what he's trying to articulate. And then that gets worked out that that's where the action's at. So yeah, you might have some political communities out there, but they rise and fall. I mean, that's not where the action's at. And yeah, you have families, but what really matters is your membership in the family of God. You have to put the premium on that. And we'll kind of work out on how that's a little more complicated, I would say, in Christian teaching and practice, but that's his argument. It becomes the primary way of seeing the world.
Well, that's what I wanted to bring up. So you said that it might be a little more complicated from the Christian perspective, because he says, as I wondered, this was a moment in the book where I thought, are you taking your thesis too far? This is on page 144 in chapter 3 on religion. He said, we may commonly think of religion as concerned with the supernatural, and it usually is, but the deepest roots of religion lie in this earth, in man's experience of the social and moral community that religion has everywhere provided in one shape or another. To me, that's, I mean, he's, he, I, it's, it, he, I think he's half right, right? In some ways that he's, that it, there is a need for community, but he's kind of diminishing the religious community to something that is more of a, I don't know, a social, like a necessary good, one way to say that, but not something that has divine origins or divine inspiration or whatever. And I guess, I don't know, I actually don't know Nisbet's religious convictions or if he has any. But to me, I will start with Paul. Do you think he takes that too far? I mean, do you think he kind of, he's good on the religious community, but he doesn't really get it. He doesn't understand kind of the theological, spiritual aspects of this. Is that fair?
Well, it reminds me a lot of Lewis's essay in the tool shed of the looking at the beam of light versus looking along the beam of light. And so Nisbet's writing as a sociologist here, and he's citing Durkheim and others who are studying religion as a phenomenon, an observable kind of phenomenon. And so he's not really going into he doesn't want to go into the metaphysics of this. He's not really going to go into, is God real or not so much. And so he's kind of analyzing the way it ties together. But I do think, I mean, there's disagreements within the Christian tradition on this of, some parts of the Christian tradition are extremely heavenly minded of, our hope is in the next world, and that's where we got to focus all our attention. But there's others that see the kingdom of heaven breaking in on earth. And so Luke mentioned Augustine, which figures prominently in Nisbet, rightfully so, of the city of God and the city of man. And so Augustine, obviously there is the reality of God and the eternal kingdom, but like God's kingdom has real impact and a lot of heft and meaning and weight now for how you deal with the fall of Rome or for how you deal with, education or career or so I see, I guess I'm hesitant to go too far. I think he's doing the analysis here. And I also have a sympathy of I think that Christianity actually has a lot more to do with people and communities than we sometimes give it credit for. It's not just about belief in an afterlife down the road.
Yeah. Luke, what do you think about that?
What Paul said is correct. So Nisbet, personally, as far as I can tell, all the accounts I've heard, he did not have the religious button. He just was not religious, just didn't go to church. He didn't think about it in that way. And I think one way of seeing it, I actually the Meditations in a Tool Shed is a great way of looking at it. He looked at religion, and that's what he's doing as a scholar. He's citing the sociologists who were studying religion, but he himself never looked through, looked along, or looked down, through the shaft, I should say. I guess
Right.
he only looked at it, and he just, and it, you know, and it's great stuff from that perspective. And I guess be aware if you're a listener, he's not looking at the perspective of stepping into the shaft, which is, you know, is perfectly legitimate. But that is what he's doing. He's looking at it.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I think
Could
that's
I?
interesting about Nisbet, by the way. And Luke, you may have, I don't have her permission to say this, but I know someone, and you two do as well, someone who knew Nisbet personally. And she would tell us that it was always striking how much Nisbet wrote about community, but he seemed to never be really connected to one,
That's
right?
right.
And so
Yeah.
he's very insightful, but you think to yourself, there's just like, there's a little something missing here because you're not inside of it. Yeah, what were you going to say, Paul?
Well, I mean, on that point, this is maybe why he knows about anti-society too. You know,
Right.
he's sort of seen that in his own life. I wanted to add here, you know, we'll talk about pluralism and ecological. I actually think the revolutionary community is in some ways the most important part of this book
Okay, and
and the
what do you
most
think he means
important.
by that? Yeah, let's go on to that next. What is the
Yeah,
revolutionary
it's
community?
I found it fascinating, and it kind of dovetails a lot with, in some ways, like Hannah Arendt and totalitarianism. Like revolutionary community and totalitarianism are linked pretty closely. But what's so interesting about the revolutionary community to me is that the revolutionary community kind of mixes the military, the political, and the religious. So it has a political vision of some sort, but it's very militaristic. Think about communism, right? Like communism structures tend to be very militaristic in their organization and their methods and structure, to achieve some kind of political outcome. It's very Rousseauian, and we can kind of go into the influence of Rousseau and how Rousseau does a lot of like messes a lot of things up. But what also I find interesting is the revolutionary community has a religious component. Now, one of the things that Nisbet talks about religion that I think is really insightful is he says religion focuses on the sacred community and it sacralizes things. That is to say, religion helps us know when things are sanctified and appropriate or not appropriate, when how we relate to family or others or wealth. And so in Christian religion, you have, okay, sex within marriage, good and proper, outside of marriage, not so good, and there's a reason for that. It sacralizes it or sanctifies it in a sense. What's interesting and really disturbing about the revolutionary community is that the revolutionary community does a similar kind of thing. It sanctifies certain kinds of beliefs and certain kinds of actions, and very specifically, revolutionary communities tend to sanctify violence. Right, so that it's not just violence is not just a necessary evil to achieve some end. No, actually, violence is a kind of goodness in the pursuit of the objectives of the revolutionaries. And the religious element you also see in ideas of purity, right? There's a kind of purity you want sort of in Christian religion, but there's a purity, an ideological purity that's sought after in revolutionary communities. And how do you maintain purity over time? By purging.
Yeah.
And so this is why we see purges happen repeatedly in Russia, the Soviet Union, and in China, these other places. It's part of this community that is just churning and pursuing. And Nisbet doesn't go in this direction, but I would posit that the real challenge of, or the problem with the revolutionary community is that it has no grounding really in metaphysics, right? That what they try to achieve is impossible. And so it churns and churns and churns. And just kind of eats itself. And so you see this in the French Revolution, and you see this in various communist regimes where that they can never arrive because there's no metaphysical end that they can actually approach and reach. Now, the last thing I'll say, and I would love to hear Luke's thoughts if I'm getting this right or not. The last thing I'll say about why I think the revolutionary community is so important is it's a modern phenomenon. It explains a lot of the totalitarian tragedies and massacres we've seen against Soviet Union, China being the biggest ones. But I also think it is the most important in understanding what's going on the political left right now. And some of the and are the moment that we're in right now, we're in kind of a revolutionary moment in a sense. And you see it especially on the left. You see a little bit of it on the right too, and that's also concerning. And that's part of the conversations on the right. But you see, like, cultural Marxism is this kind of revolutionary community, and it makes a lot of sense of like the transgender crusades of, you know, it's not enough. It's not the revolutionary community is not just about, okay, we're going to change our political relationships a little bit. It's actually, we're going to change you, the person, because as Rousseau would say, you have to want the right things, or you have to change. So like LGBTQ is a perfect example. Why are they so militant? Right? You say, look, I'm not, I'll tolerate you or whatever. That's not good enough. Because the revolutionary community, you have to believe what they believe. You have to accept and affirm. And this is why you get these really deep conflicts, because it's not just about some kind of political relationship. It's actually about this sort of internal, so Rousseau and General Will. Anyway, so the point is, I see lots of elements of revolutionary community all around us right now. And I think that's part of what's leading to all of the divides and a lot of the conflict ideologically we've seen over the last 10 to 15 years, especially.
I want to give Luke a chance to respond to that, but it strikes me, Paul, and I don't remember this coming up in the chapter, but what you were describing sounds a lot like what the modern Gnosticism that Eric Voegelin describes. I don't know if Nisbet says that, although I think that essay is coming out around the same time or a little bit before this. It'd be interesting to know kind of a comparison between Nisbet and Voegelin on that particular question, because I think you're right, unfortunately. We do see it on the right as well, right? There's this purity contest. I've said this before in other contexts, is that as the director of a conservative organization, I'm terrified, and I shouldn't say terrified. I avoid explaining what I mean by conservative, because nowadays that's a minefield. And we and our organization encompasses quite a few different definitions of that, and deliberately so. Just like we incorporate Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox, I wouldn't call us completely ecumenical because we stick with the Nicene Creed. You need to be theologically Orthodox, etc. But anyone's welcome at our conferences, by the way, for those listening, even those of no faith or a different faith. It's open to all. But Luke, I guess I would respond to that. I mean, is the revolutionary chapter the most important? And maybe. As I think, as you suggest at the beginning, and we'll come back to the ecological one, but you suggest the plural community chapter, it might actually be more important. What do you think?
I think the plural community is that chapter is really important because it's Nisbet's alternative. Like, here's the answer. The revolutionary community chapter, though, it explains our moment perfectly. So I wrote an essay in 2020 for Law and Liberty, where I argued that what we were seeing in the riots in that summer, that was the revolutionary community at work. And this went through Nisbet's with six or seven elements of the revolutionary community and here how they were playing out. Right in front of us. And so, I think Nisbet's brilliant insight here is he says there's these three major types of community, but sometimes they fail. And that is they don't somehow religion is just opaque. It doesn't the community does not get people into it. The political community is somehow failing for us to take pride in our citizenship. Our families have already been decimated and degraded. And so we turn to revolution. And what they do is combine the three elements, the three communities. And it's through violence, just like the military community, they will seize political power. And they do it on the behalf of dogmas. So we have these dogma of equality, for example, or the dogma of whatever it is, equality is a big one. And by equality, meaning utter absolute annihilation of difference between it. But you can see other dogmas, and so, race can be a dogma. So we've seen this could be any race that makes it the core revolutionary dogma. And the terrifying thing is. He talks about he has two of the elements are one is terror, so the use of violence and terror, and that you see these in the authors he brings out, they're a good thing. He calls this the holiness of sin. So normally we think of like when you go to war, you have to kill people, but this is a necessary evil, and so we have all these doctrines of just war trying to limit it and to explain when it's necessary, but it's never seen as isn't it great that we slaughter. Enough enemy troops that they give in. We never say, and that's a good thing. We say it's a necessary thing insofar as we'll keep our people safe or we'll get this territory secured or whatever. But that's it. But that's not what the revolutionary community says. It says terror is absolutely necessary to extirpate evil out of this world. So there is, and it's another aspect of it is there is a fundamental goodness at the heart of the world. And we have to get there by destroying and cutting down everything that has been built on top of it. You can see Rousseau sitting at the back of all this. And so we have to utterly annihilate it. And so that's why you can go where, you have the Tsar in Russia, it's authoritarian. There's plenty of things to criticize, but you go from the Tsar kills people, but he kills people who are like anarchist and trying to assassinate the czar. Like, that's who he's killing. And that's who he's, suppressing and putting in jail. Then you go to suddenly there's millions of people being, tortured and killed in the most horrific ways imaginable. That's just, the czar would have never occurred to, like, kill people by tying them up and throwing them in a vat of acid. That's just not what they did. And so you end, because it has to be terrifying. And I argued that in a few places that that's what cancel culture was all about. It was a part of the revolution community. All of us are going to worry that we lose our jobs, lose our families, lose our friends, and spend the rest of our lives in poverty. Maybe not dead, although maybe dead, definitely have a ruined life. I'm worried about the next 4 or 5 decades being utterly annihilated. That's what I have to think about every time I get in front of a podcast mic or the classroom. I have to worry that that's going to happen.
This is a trap, Luke. You're here.
Well, and to Luke's, I think Luke answers your question too indirectly there, Josh. You can see the Gnosticism in what Luke is saying, right? Like, there's this evil and there's the good, and it's in people and in ideas, and we just need to annihilate and get rid of the evil. And that you get that kind of Gnostic element of this dichotomy. And this is why Solzhenitsyn, coming out of totalitarian Soviet Union, emphasizes and is so well known for saying the line between good and evil runs through every human heart, right? It's not sort of an us them evil good, but like actually within the human person, and sort of pushing back against this kind of Gnosticism.
Yep. So let's go back then. We got two communities left. We have the ecological community, which I'm labeling the hippie community, and then the plural community, which again is alternative. We've toyed around with that. Explain. I'd love to hear. We'll start with Luke. Luke, explain what the ecological community is, and I especially would love to hear Paul respond to then. Nisbet's picture here, especially as an economist, because I'm reading the ecological community, and at first I thought this was going to be all about environmental thought, which it's a little bit in there, but it's not. It's really, again, I'm using the word hippie flippantly, but this is published in 1973. I can feel that going on here, right? And there's something endearing about this chapter where I'm like, why not? There's just half of me's there. It's the other side of the coin of the revolutionary community, right? So, Luke, explain what the ecological community is, and Paul, I guess, respond to that.
Yeah, so Nisbet sees kind of two major alternatives to the failure of the three major types of community. One is revolution, which we talked about. The other one is withdrawal. So those three communities just aren't doing it, but we're going to go and form a community out on the mountaintop. And we're going to live there and kind of by our rules. And we can therefore have a meaningful community until eventually the political order may come around or the religious order may come around. So you see Saint Benedict as the first kind of manifestation of this. So he's not, they're religious, but they're not turning to the church. Well, that's okay. I'll just make sure to spend lots of time at mass. That's not what he says. He says, we're going to go out and form a community on the mountaintop. And we're going to live by a rule. And this will be our community because those other communities aren't doing it for us anymore. And we see then lots of manifestations of this. And Nisbet did see the kind of hippie communes as being some sort of version of this. And he has a bit of a soft spot for a version of anarchism not the revolutionary anarchists, that's another part, but the ones that said, we can withdraw and form communes and live in community with each other, and this be a stable alternative to the failure of the political community. And so he has a bit of a soft spot for it too, and from my perspective, maybe too much of a soft spot for those sorts of efforts. But he sees them as really interesting aspects. There's other aspects to it. You withdraw, but you also form a community, and he sees it as it's going to have to be voluntary. It also will kind of grow naturally. We can kind of live naturally out on the mountaintop. So it's why, modern ecological communities, the Amish, what are they? They're farmers. We go out and we're going to live on the land in natural communities with people naturally close to us in our immediate vicinity will be our church. So it's all a very kind of natural, voluntary way of living. And that this is how a community works. So it's interesting because he ties it into also Adam Smith and some of the other physiocrats, but he sees them as, what they were looking around at the economy and saying, there's a natural growth to it, a kind of natural way in which the economy will grow and wealth will grow if it's kind of left to itself in terms of voluntary association between consumers and producers and that sort of thing. So it's a really interesting framing of this way of thought. So notice he doesn't break it up into there's the the anarchist over there, and they're this one type of thing. It says, well, there's different types of anarchists. They're actually articulating very, very different visions of community. Some are in the revolutionary community, but some are in this withdrawal community, which is very different.
I think the ecological community, the withdrawal is a really important point, and the voluntary element is a really important point. Because even when you get political philosophers like Locke or others and the social contract and people agree, they don't really agree. They sort of acquiesce. And the ecological community, which has a lot of utopian elements, is that no, people actually choose to be here and they can actually leave. The exit option is real. The participation is optional and voluntary. And so that brings a lot of great things. And Adam Smith would talk about this spontaneous order and so on. It is the question then becomes, how do ecological communities exist within broader societies? And the Amish are an interesting example. Kibbutzes, in Israel, are an example. Again, agrarian. Mennonites, more agrarian. And they live much more simply, generally speaking, for both religious reasons and practical reasons. And so I think this is a good way to transition into the plural community, because there's a lot of connections between the plural community and the ecological community, because the plural community is similar, except that it recognizes its place within the broader political community. And so the best way to think about pluralism, and this is, Nisbet cites this, this is an older phrase, is a community of communities. That is to say, you have lots of different communities, and then they form sort of a broader community. And he argues that the medieval period is actually much like this. So it's a religious community for sure in Western Europe, but it's also pluralist in some respects, in that you have a lot of decentralized power, you have different political decentralization, different religious decentralization. And the difference, I would say, between sort of the pluralism he advocates today versus the medieval pluralism is that voluntary element. So medieval world, community of communities, not super voluntary, right? You're sort of born where you are. You can't move around. You're kind of very static and pretty stuck. Versus today, lots of mobility, lots of movement. And so the plural vision today, community of communities, is voluntary, which has more of this ecological flavor. But the challenge then becomes, and this is kind of, what I'm still wrestling with having read the book, is what is the binding elements of the community over the communities? And so what I read this as, and sort of how I live actually, is really pressing into forming and being part of local communities and associations. And we want to have a really robust view of those things. So just to give you a tangible example, there's a big difference in my mind between a church that people attend kind of when they feel like it or every Sunday versus a church where you have membership and there's a process to become a member and there's obligations being a member and you can be kicked out, church discipline for being a member. That kind of church is a more sort of robust community in a lot of ways. That is to say, it has other elements than purely, hey, we're just happen to be showing up at the same time and talking. It's like, no, actually, you have commitment and obligations and accountability and governance structure, even that you think about leadership within those churches. So even within churches, I think you can have kind of more thicker sort of communities that govern themselves in real ways versus churches that are just kind of more associational and kind of passing. And so a pluralist world is, hey, these churches should be really thick kinds of places, and schools should be kind of thick kind of places where it's not just I show up to class and I leave, but there's actually structure to how I interact with my fellow students and with my professors, and there's expectations and there's, layers of connection. And so the reason I think he finds the plural community so attractive is it is this sort of robust or strong community or communities that we try to form that are able to exist and to help us to have meaning without going down the totalitarian route or the kind of centralization route of a political or military community.
Now, I want to give Luke a chance to talk about the plural community, but one of the things that came to mind when I was reading this chapter was the notions of subsidiarity and sphere sovereignty. I don't remember him using those words, to me it seems like he's kind of moving in that direction. But Luke, you've said it a couple times now, this plural community, it's his answer, right? It's his or his alternative. Like, this is probably the best we can do. Is that kind of what you see him doing in this chapter?
So what he's trying to get at is describing a type of community that will help us distinguish, a political community from a monistic, kind of top-down, centralized political community. So his language is somewhat imprecise, and you have to kind of work out what he's trying to get at. So he would say, I think, although he doesn't quite say it this way, is that the United States is a plural community. It's in the name. So it's not one monistic unified state. It's actually a collection of states with an overall, it's a single community. We have one constitutional system, but also 50 constitutional systems at the same time. And the intent and what, Madison and others are trying to articulate was that complexity. And some of the sometimes the anti-federalists are in the Federalists are talking past each other because the Federalists are trying to say, look, it's going to be complicated. It's a plural community. There's going to be states and the federal government, and they're interacting in these super complicated ways. And the Anti-Federalists are like, yeah, but then what happens to the states? Because they're thinking in some ways monistically, the state or the national state, which one? And so I think, we can think of our country as being a plural community. But that's just the beginning. So it's decentralized in an important way. But it's decentralized also between political and social authorities. So even a lot of these states were at the time collection of towns. And the town government was the real was where the real action was at. For 99% of what you had to obey, that was going to come from your town or your county. So there was these little local communities that did a lot of things. There were also churches that were doing lots of things and making very real claims upon their members. And then families are making real claims upon their members. And the reason I say religion, the religious community is a little more complicated is Christian teaching, I think, kind of forthrightly recognizes the legitimacy of other authorities. The political authority does legitimate things, and you are to submit yourself to the wielder of the sword of justice. And that is a legitimate authority. You are to submit yourself to your parents. They have legitimate authority over you. Children obey your parents, and it doesn't say children only obey your Christian parents. Obey your parents. Now, of course, there can be conflict, and that is also recognized in Scripture. And if push really does come to shove, you do have to pick Christ over these other communities. The teaching is very clear that it better not be your fault. If you're breaking with your family over religion, it better be because your family is breaking with you. You don't break with your family. Your family breaks with you. So I would say that Christianity, this is, Christ obviously is supreme, but all of these other communities are entirely legitimate within their own spheres. Nisbet doesn't use, as you say, it doesn't use the religious language of subsidiarity or sphere sovereignty, but it very much melds with what he's saying. And I'm sure he was familiar with it. My guess is the reason he doesn't use that language is he doesn't want to be accused of just, being a pseudo-Catholic and just kind of saying, oh, hey, look it, the Catholics have the answer here. Instead of he's trying to give a sociological answer from the study of social thought that's independent, but it very much dovetails with sphere sovereignty and Kuiper and with the Catholic tradition of subsidiarity and that whole encyclicals. And I should say that Nisbet has a review essay on Voegelin, since he's come up a few
Really?
times. So he read Voegelin, and he has this lengthy review essay of a couple of Voegelin books and books about Voegelin. Loved him. He thought Voegelin was brilliant and was getting everything right. So I think it's safe to say that correspondence is definitely there.
I think I'd add just briefly too, like on the religious community, one thing that Nisbet highlights is that the religious community does have a tiny revolutionary element, or it is subversive of military and political kind of communities. And then he just talks about that, of the loyalty piece is really where it comes in. Of you can live in political communities or other kinds of communities as a Christian, and there's legitimate authority, but you can't give your final allegiance to it. And that's why, with Augustine, city of God, city of man, that yeah, you live in the city of man, but you're a member of the city of God. There's that primary element, and especially in societies that are really totally structured around a political view or around a military view, that's sort of anathema. And that's why you had a lot of opposition to early Christians or Christians in general, because it doesn't fit this sort of sole allegiance that the state or the military or the revolutionary community might demand.
So I want to close now with go ahead and use this as a moment to say, any last words you want to give about the book. But also, I found myself thinking throughout the book, he's on a very he's on a descriptive mission primarily, trying to say, let's analyze the history. And the dude has read everything. When I look at the index, it does not do justice to every single thing that's in here. It is he has read everything. I will never catch up. But it's I kept asking myself, what is community for? Is community for Nisbet an end in itself? Because we hear a lot of talk nowadays about I just want community. I just want community. And that kind of gets back to what Nisbet's been saying all along. Like that is a very, very human desire. And we can form these different communities, we can distinguish and be more discerning. And I think that's one of the biggest the helpful piece of this here is that not all communities are the same, not all communities exist for the same reasons, but whatever the because this would be the critique that you could hear from the right in particular of the plural community is okay, what in the world does it exist for, right? Is it does it exist for itself? Just okay, like hey, is it merely about survival, right? And peace and kind of Hobbesian sense? Is it merely to protect private property in kind of a crude Lockean sense? And so I think there's I was a little dissatisfied by the end of the book saying okay. We all want community. Yes, you're right, Nisbet. Why? Okay, but and maybe the answers are different. I guess I what do you feel about that question? Does he someone answer that? Does he leave it hanging on purpose? What is community for? Luke, we'll go start with you.
Yeah, so in some ways, what you're bringing up would be an acceptable critique, I think, of Nisbet. So he's a sociologist. He's coming at it from that direction. I think what he's identifying is it is absolutely impossible to be outside a community. Now, we treat it in kind of an ephemeral sense. It's kind of great if you can like go to a church and then like you're a part of it. But if you don't like it, that's cool. Just go to a different one or stop going. I mean, whatever. We don't see it as these communities are absolutely essential. And he says they are. And when you see them recede, there's massive social pathologies that come in and rise in insanity, rise in suicide, rise in deaths of despair, and then totalitarian movements because they offer community. That's one thing that the revolution community offers is absolute, complete community. And so why do people join those movements? Because they get a deliverance of the province. We will decide everything for you. We'll impose dogma on you, and you have to believe it. You follow absolute orders. It's great. Trust me, your need for community will be met. And so that's what makes them so dangerous, as precisely that. But Nisbet says it's impossible to not have this. So we really need to understand community in itself as a good in itself. So it's a good in itself, he would say, psychologically and sociologically, that people go to a religious ceremony every week because it's just good to be a part of a community and that they feel a part of it. Whether or not it's true is just for him an entirely separate question. And as I kind of intimated, he might have thought it somewhat irrelevant or just beyond sociology to answer. He's not concerned with it in that sense. So that would be one thing is it's not, I would say is the church, the kind of the lesson I think the church and Christians ought to take from it is we can't just say, yeah, but we got our doctrines right. It's like, right. But did you form a community around those doctrines such that people can be integrated into the sacraments and into the teaching of the word? If you failed on that amount, Nisbet's critique is somewhat right. Well, it doesn't really matter that you got your doctrines right because you failed at the human level of connecting with the actual parishioners. You failed on that level. So I have to say, that's kind of Nisbet's giving us 100% of that 50%.
Yeah, I would agree, and I think you're not going to get the metaphysical answers that you want here in terms of what's it really for, and how do we know, and what are the guiding metrics. Luke's right, and I think what it reminds me of is some of the work of Jonathan Haidt, today. And you know, his book, The Righteous Mind, he has this line at the beginning, which is just another way of saying, I think, what Nisbet's saying, that everybody's born to be righteous, they just have to figure out what to be righteous about. And like Nisbet would say, everyone's born to be in a community, they just have to figure out what community they're going to end up being a part of. Or you have this disintegration, the anti-community, I suppose, that leads to these pathologies that were just mentioned. And so, yeah, I think it's not an option of whether you have community or whether there will be community. It's that nature abhors a vacuum, and it abhors a social vacuum as much as it abhors, you know, physical vacuums. And this is, I think, why he was so concerned and wrote so extensively about community and the quest for community. And is, well, what happens when you get a vacuum, right? When you get a vacuum, you have this revolutionary community is the one that tends to come in. Sometimes you get the ecological in the plural, but that's unusual. Usually it's revolutionary, as people are grasping for power. And also you get this kind of pendulum. You know, Martin Luther said once, mankind is like a drunk on a donkey. You're gonna fall off one side and get back up and fall off on the other side. And we go between these extremes. And so what happens when communities become weak in just not a power sense, but in a meaning sense and a binding and tie sense, what happens in that world? You fall off the donkey one side, well, you move to the opposite, right? Which is the revolutionary community, as Luke referred to, which is total, right? And totalitarian, everything completely dominating, everything is committed to this thing. And that's very dangerous and causes all kinds of problems and tyranny and so forth. And so that's why it matters. And so, you know, I guess, you know, there's more questions we could definitely go into here. I'm always wondering, like, can you have a good political community? So as a Christian, it's sort of like, I'm not sure you can have like a good total political community or total military community. Like those don't seem like relevant options to me, but maybe they were really good examples and it was really fulfilling for people, but I have some doubts.
And this just to close here, then and Paul, I invite you because you and I have talked about this before separately. Is one of the things that's missing here, and I don't know if this is a separate community or not. It's kind of a piece of a plural community, is the idea of an intellectual community. Now, obviously, that's a self-serving, question thing, because that's what the Ciceronian society is. In many ways, we are intellectuals seeking our own community, right? In the sense that we're not trying to order a large social world, if that makes sense, but that we have particular interests and desires and things that just we'd like to talk about, like this, right? And so I think there's something to be said about. I don't know if I think Nisbet would have probably agreed with this. It's not necessarily a giant ordering force necessarily. It wouldn't be as large as any of these six major and minor keys, as you called them. But the notion of an intellectual community might be something that we could add to this, because it does it it's encouraging, it's life-giving, it helps us write better, it helps us teach better, it helps us communicate better. It reminds us why we're even doing what we're doing. Would you agree with that, Paul?
Yeah, I would. And, you know, again, sorry, we'll leave people wanting more because I'm going to throw out another big topic here. And I'm
Okay.
curious what Luke thinks about this as well. Is one thing that is very absent from this book is any real reflection or description of friendship
Yep.
and what friendship is and what it looks like. And that, you know, his other books, you know, Quest for Community, he gets into it, I think, a little bit more. But that is, you know, in our conversations and like Ciceronian and something I think about. Is and like people who are inspired by Nisbet, like Bowling Alone, Putnam, and others, like friendship features more prominently, and I think rightfully so. That to answer your question or to think about the kinds of communities you want to form and how we do it and what they do, we really need to think a much harder about friendship and what friendship is and how we form it, what it means, and the different kinds of friendships. And so there's an intellectual friendship, which might be different from the friendship I have with my neighbor or the friendship that I have with someone at church, but we have different occupations and so forth. So, you know, we've spent a lot of time talking about friendship, but that's something where I think that will help answer the question you're asking and thinking through what does the intellectual community have to offer that is maybe not hard to find or can't find in other places.
Luke, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, that's right. It's kind of interesting. The study of friendship, I think everybody knows Aristotle's discussion, but one thing that's missing in a lot of analyses, and I think it's fair to say Nisbet doesn't quite hone in like he should, despite the fact he knows Aristotle, is on what friendships are and how that relates. I had a I have a paper I presented at Ciceronian Society last year on friendships and kind of using that as a model to think through First Amendment rights. So what are we talking about here? Is we're talking about, you know, friendships, maybe certain types of friendships that can form, and that may be one way of looking at it. So that is somewhat missing from Nisbet's analysis, and I think you could say the plural community is one that is open to all these different types of communities getting together. And so it would go all the way down to this neighborhoods and friendship associations and all these voluntary groups like the Ciceronian Society that would form around a plethora of different causes and themes, and that all of them are good. And where, yeah, the next step he doesn't quite give is because you become friends with all those people around those things. And I think that's where Aristotle's insight is almost unmatched. And to kind of give another layer here, John Finnis talks about sociability, which friendship is what he's talking about, is a human good that has no kind of an irreducible human good. And I think, and I'm trying in that paper to bring that in, that irreducible human good is why we have free associations, and it's why it ought to be protected, actually, in constitutional laws, because you're securing this fundamental human good.
Well, on that note, gentlemen, thank you so much. This is a great conversation.
Yeah,
Thank
thanks for
you.
having us. It was fun.
And if you enjoyed this conversation, you can get a lot more of this at a Ciceronian Society conference. We're headed to Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, March 12th through the 14th, 2026. We now have a membership program, and one of the best ways to be invited and nominated for that membership program is to come to our conference, get to know us, become part of our community, right? It's not the only way to become a member, but it certainly is probably the smoothest ride there, if you will. And we hope you'll join us for that event. And actually, relevant to this discussion, remember that we have a set of fellowships that accepted panelists, which as of this recording, I have not notified everybody yet, but they can now apply for these fellowships, and they're named after Robert Nisbet because of how much he overlaps with our themes. And we also have separate fellowships for clergy as well. The deadline for those applications is December 1st each year, and more information and eligibility requirements are on our website. All right, now be sure to rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, check out our website at ciceroniansociety.org. Now may the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us all evermore. Thank you for listening.